You're listening to Sex Gets Real with Dawn Sarah. That's me. This is a place where we explore sex, bodies, and relationships from a place of curiosity and inclusion, tying the personal to the cultural, where you're just as likely to hear tender questions about shame and the complexities of love as you are to hear experts challenging the dominant stories around pleasure, body politics, and liberation. This is about the big and the small, about sex and everything surrounding it we don't usually name. The funny, the awkward, the imperfect happen here in service to joy, connection, healing, and creating healthier relationships with ourselves and each other. So welcome to Sex Gets Real. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Hey you, welcome to part three of our three-part conversation about Eve Rickert's experience with Franklin Vo and the larger dialogue that we are engaging in around things like emotional abuse, gaslighting, community accountability, and alternative justice practices, which is where we're going today. So part one, for those of you who haven't heard it yet, was my chat with Eve Rickert, who is the co-author of the polyamory book, More Than Two. Part two was a great conversation with therapist Samantha Manowitz about emotional abuse and gaslighting. And what you're about to hear today is part three in our series with Ida Mandule, who is a therapist and an incredible human being who is doing so much amazing work in the world. And one of the many hats that Ida wears is as a consultant in helping communities and groups engage in transformative justice processes and community engagement. So, this isn't about monsters, bad guys, punitive justice, or victim blaming. What we're hoping with these conversations is that it invites all of us into, myself included, examining how normalized abusive behaviors are in our culture and our relationships, the ways that we subtly manipulate, coerce, and even harm the people in our lives, and how we can start doing better. We're hoping that we can all start being more critical of celebrity culture, especially when those being centered are able-bodied white cis men, and also critical of who controls the narratives that are being told and sold. And it's not that white cis men don't have things to offer, because they absolutely do, but what we're inviting is, how can we center other voices to make space for other stories and perspectives? That's the only way that we get free. Today, Ida and I are going to dive into why we would even want to engage in alternative justice processes, lessons that Ida has learned from being involved in multiple processes and accountability groups, why we need to grieve stories that we carry around urgency and healing and harm and what justice even looks like, why vilifying individuals actually can contribute to more harm happening, and how we can bring these ideas into our personal lives on a really micro scale in our most intimate relationships, because that impacts the macro, that impacts the communities we're in, the other people in our lives. So how can we make this really personal? So much of what we discuss in this episode is about a different way to do relationships and to be in community. And one of the things that Ida says that I loved is that these processes aren't new, but many of us are new to them, which makes them feel new, but they've been around for a really long time. And we're inviting you to ask, who is your community? Who are your people? What kind of accountability do you have in place? And how can you start building more accountability into those spaces so that when harm happens, because harm is inevitable between human beings, how can we create more space for support and healing that doesn't just make everything crumble, that doesn't push the people who have been harmed or victimized off to the side, there's a better way to do all of this. I can't wait for you to hear this conversation, but before we jump in, I just want to let you know that the July cohort for my Pleasure, Power and Pleasure online course is now enrolling. So emails are coming in every single day from the people that are in the current cohort, and there have been so many conversations that we've had in the group calls that have brought us to tears, that have left me just full of goosebumps and shivers. It's incredible seeing what's unfolding. And just this morning, someone actually wrote to me and said, "Dawn, I am loving your course so far. I didn't realize that we would receive reflection questions every day. The consistency helps keep everything percolating in my brain, and I have luckily been able to make a decent amount of time every day during nap time to sit and ponder and feel. Thank you for sparking that." And even inside the course, someone just commented a couple of days ago, "I think this is going to change my life." Thank you, Dawn, for your wisdom on the group call and the breath-giving module. If you want to explore your relationship to pleasure, your stories around pleasure, if you want to release old stories about being worthy and deserving, if pleasure feels complicated for you, then I would love to have you join us for the July cohort of this 5-week course. You can go to dawnsarah.com/pleasure course and check out all of the details and the price for the course. It's super reasonable. And there's multiple price points depending on kind of your needs. And we start July 22nd, 2019. I would love to see you there. So back to my chat with Ida. If you support the show on Patreon, at $3 a month and above, then you get access to weekly bonus content that you can't hear anywhere else. And this week, Ida and I chatted after our conversation for the main part of the podcast, and we dove into what helps and what hurts an accountability process. And I just have to say, we can learn so much from Ida. And I suspect you're really going to like our little bonus chat. So if you go to patreon.com/sgrpodcast for Sex Gets Real, SGR Podcast, to tune in. Or if you haven't already, lend a few dollars every month to show the show some support. You can also support at $5 a month and above, and you can help me field listener questions. So $3, you get the weekly bonus. $5 a month, you get to help me answer listener questions and the weekly bonus. So patreon.com/sgrpodcast. Let me tell you a little bit about Ida, and then we're jumping in. Ida Mondelez is an award-winning Latinx activist, international presenter, and trauma-focused clinician, known for big earrings and building bridges. Trained as a sexuality educator, social worker, and nonprofit management professional, they're working to make the world a more equitable place through education, therapy, and community organizing. Their perspective centers intersectionality and maximizing kindness while retaining both a sense of humor and a sense of justice. From the New York Times to the Rainbow Times, Ida has been interviewed by a variety of media outlets. They were even brought on for a debate on the Laura Ingraham Show, a popular conservative radio program, and lived to tell the tale. Here is my chat with Ida. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Ida. I love talking with you always, and I'm so excited that you're going to be here talking about alternative justice with us.
Hell yeah. I'm excited to be here too.
Good. You are doing work with the pod that's involved in Eve Rickard's process. I know you're helping to consult and offer guidance around the alternative justice process that they're engaged in. And you have also been a part of a number of other pods. And since this is a process that a lot of us are new to or haven't had any experience with, I'd love it if we could just start like really basic and kind of high level. Why alternative justice practices, and what can they offer us that's different?
Yes. The biggest question people ask is why? And is this something that we've done before and all these different things? And frankly, the criminal legal system is failing so many of us. I'm not going to say it's not working, because it is working. It's just working towards some goals that I think are not great for the planet, not great for society. So the criminal legal system in a lot of ways is working to incarcerate a lot of folks for nonviolent offenses, especially drug offenses. The criminal legal system has been created in an environment of racism and misogyny and ableism and all these different structures that make it so that certain people get justice and a lot of people don't. And not everyone is even operating under the same definition of justice. So community accountability work and alternative justice systems really are a way to look outside of the criminal legal system and look toward our history, as well as our future and our own communities for the solutions, rather than these power structures that have been in place for a while that are not serving a lot of us. And again, when I say that, that's why I try to be very specific. It's not serving all of us, and it is serving very specific aims, because I think a lot of people get tangled in this argument of, well, but do you just not want cops? Do you just not want prisons? And they a little bit miss the point. So the, at least to me, the point is, how can we find options, right? Mm-hmm. We don't all want to eat the same food. We all don't want to live in the same kind of housing. Why would we have only one kind of format for justice and seeking healing if in so many ways we all need different things? So to me, this is part of that, of providing options for people. To me, part of what they can offer us that the criminal legal system is not offering us is a more grassroots approach to healing and justice. If we're looking at large systems like the criminal legal system, we don't have as much of a hand in it as individuals, right? You know, to dispense justice and to have access to resources, that relates to having money, that relates to speaking a particular kind of language and lingo. A lot of laws are not necessarily created with the context that we would want to use them in mind. And so, it's just insufficient to me. And so the idea here is that we can create things that are more tailored to us, that have different value systems undergirding them, and that are generally more compassionate. The criminal legal system is not concerned with compassion whatsoever. And that, I think, is a critical component of being able to fix social harms and address social harms better.
Well, I have to say I am 1,000% on board with doing something that's more about strengthening community and offering more options and really undermining a system that profits off of vilifying and criminalizing very specific groups of people and types of people, and the ways that power gets distributed inside of that and who profits off of it. So that is really exciting to me. One of the things that I'm also really interested in, and I've seen different versions of this with different community accountability processes over the past couple of years, but how can these types of approaches serve us if, say, the person who's causing harm doesn't want to participate, and even vice versa, if maybe the person who has caused harm is looking for an alternative way of doing this work, but then the people who have been harmed don't want to participate? How can we build processes around different levels of willingness to engage?
That's actually one of my favorite parts of this. You can't really do criminal legal work if some of those parties are missing. But you can extremely do different kinds of community accountability with missing parties, quote unquote missing parties. So to me, that's also a question of one of the specific frameworks that I use, transformative justice, which I super didn't make up, right? That's a framework that has been built upon over years and decades, primarily founded and used by Black women. And really in conversation with restorative justice that has way older roots in a lot of indigenous communities here and abroad, and, you know, folks that then brought it more to the legal system in the 70s and 80s. But with this kind of approach, we just have a lot of different opportunities for engagement. So to me, one of the beauties of it is that we can look at what conditions caused this harm to happen, or what conditions allowed this harm to happen, and how can we as a community look to that to change it. So we're looking outside of the specifics of a situation while also looking at the specifics. And to me, what that means is we don't need the humans directly involved to see, oh, you know, this kind of harm happened because this person didn't have appropriate mental health resources, or this harm happened because this person didn't have access to public transportation options that helped them, or this harm happened because this person didn't have, you know, XYZ. And even if we don't address those people that caused or received the harm, we can still work on, you know, getting better access to public transportation for folks in our community. We can talk about what it would look like to create guidelines and community building spaces for people involved in kink so that they have more of a sense of cohesion when harm happens, so that people don't feel isolated. And so there's a lot of ways to indirectly address harm that don't rely on a victim or a perpetrator coming forth or being involved in a long, you know, months long, years long process.
One of the things that I really appreciate about that, or what I feel inside of me when I hear that, is so much of the suffering that I've experienced and that I know so many of the people I've worked with have experienced is around this good survivor narrative. You have to be a certain way. You have to, you know, have learned something from this, and you've come out the other side and you're healed and you're shiny and you don't get upset about it. And there's this very like specific clean narrative that's about making other people comfortable. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about what you just said is, one, I think what's inherent in the good survivor narrative is the flip side of the coin, which is there was some monster you had to overcome. And we're kind of doing away with that, with these processes of really seeing this as like humans inside of communities, inside of systems, not just let's put all the bad people over here. I don't know, it feels like there's also more opportunity for some of the nuance around sometimes the people who have been harmed have also caused some harm, and sometimes the people causing harm are also being harmed.
Yes. Well, and honestly, one of the biggest fears that I hear from people who are not already in a survivor mode, they're just afraid of being called out and disposed of. They're terrified. Like, I have so many people, I work as a clinician as well, and I have so many people in my office that are just afraid that they're going to get booted, or because they maybe work in a very progressive community that is really centering survivors as much as they can, they're worried that if they cause harm or if they aren't perfect, they're going to get cut off from society and cut off from their supports. And on a large scale, we know that that doesn't super happen, right? Like, a lot of the folks that get accused of harm don't actually suffer many consequences. But if someone is in a community that is trying to be better about things like sexual assault, that is a possibility that they will be ostracized if they are someone who caused harm or were perceived as causing harm. And so what I think these processes give us is a not just a framework or a path, but also just a paradigm shift to understand that there is no such thing as a monster. There is no such thing as a perfect good victim or person. We all hold complexity, but that doesn't mean then that, well, we all cause harm, so everyone should just forgive each other and have it be okay. Right? Like, these processes are long for a reason, because they're generally trying to focus on addressing root causes of harm and then trying to help every party involved transform. The idea is not just let us be survivor-centered and help the survivor heal. The idea is, how can the community heal? The harm was something communal. How can the person who caused harm, you know, deal with that and be better and themselves transform, themselves deal with the obligations that their harm caused in the first place? And while that also makes it, I think, a little bit easier for people who were harmed to come forth and admit they caused harm, because they know that they would be operating in a world or in a community that's not just going to throw them away, I think it also gives survivors a space to be more complex. Like, you don't have to participate. You don't have to be happy. You can be pissed off. You can want your rapist to die in a fire, and that is okay. The thing is that the last feeling you have? Is that the last place that you land? Hopefully not, because living with a ton of anger is exhausting. And, you know, having anger is an important part of the process that a lot of people have. And here we're back to this question of timing. we can't expect survivors or anyone really to jump to logistics, to jump to how do we make this better, if we don't give them time to have a fucking feeling. You know, any mental health professional worth their salt will know and tell you that. But a lot of us, even when we know that, we don't practice it. And so to me, what's really important in doing these processes and doing them well is knowing that the timelines are going to be different for every process, and that it's going to be vital that there is space at the beginning for people to have their feelings and have those heard. A lot of people try to just jump to the, okay, so how do we fix it? How do we fix it? Without actually hearing what the feelings are and what people are sorting through. And that generally undermines the process, and it doesn't make it as long lasting or sustainable in the end. So in our attempt to cut a corner, we actually just mess up the whole process from the beginning.
I am interrupting this part of the episode to tell you that the truth is, I don't have time in my life to do all the things that need to get done. Finding small ways to ensure that I have plenty of time for play and for sex, for rest, for eating delicious food, it's an important part of how I keep going while juggling multiple companies and working long, long days. And that's why I've long been a fan of Lola. Lola is a female-founded company offering a line of organic cotton tampons, pads, and liners, and they now offer sex products too. They are generously sponsoring the show this week, and listeners, you can get 40% off your subscription, so keep listening. So here's how Lola helps me avoid period and sex crises. Their subscription is fully customizable. You can choose your mix of products, how many pads, tampons, and liners you get, the mix of absorbency you need, the number of boxes that you want, and how often they deliver. Plus, they send them in these super discreet boxes, and on the inside, everything is so pretty and put together. It's lovely branding. Lola's subscription is also really flexible. You can change and skip and cancel your subscription at any time. So if I'm going to be traveling for a couple of weeks, I can have them deliver a little bit more frequently ahead of it and then delay the subscription for that whole time that I'm away. It's super easy. Plus, it's not just period products. The Sex by Lola line is available part of the subscription too, so you can add it to your period subscription. Everything is super conveniently delivered at your ideal schedule, and I love their ultra thin condoms, which is something I'm always on the lookout for. Definitely check that out. You know, ethics are hugely important to me. So I also love that every single purchase with Lola does good. Lola donates feminine care products to homeless shelters across the US with each purchase you make. I also wanted to let you know that the FDA does not require brands to disclose a comprehensive list of ingredients that are in period care products, so most of them don't. But Lola offers complete transparency about the ingredients that are found in their tampons, pads, liners, wipes. You've heard me rant and rave about the importance of high-quality lube, non-porous toys, and now you can be confident about what's in your period products, because our genitals deserve the very best. If you want your period products and even your condoms, lube, wipes delivered to your door on your schedule with a company that believes in centering the health of your body, then check out Lola. And listeners, you can get 40% off all subscriptions. Just go to mylola.com and enter SGR as your discount code when you subscribe. So that's mylola.com. Fill your cart with your goodies and then enter the discount code SGR at checkout to save 40%. A huge thanks to Lola for supporting the show. It means so much to me. And I hope that all of you listening jump on that massive discount. It lets Lola know that this is a show that they should continue partnering with, which helps me so much. So you get a discount and you help the show when you take advantage of that discount at mylola.com and use discount code SGR at checkout. The time piece is something that I'd love to just roll around in a little bit more. I think one of the things that's so important is recognizing that a lot of the mythology that we've got right now in the stories that we consume and that we celebrate because of pop culture and Hollywood, there's this sense of immediacy and one and doneness. Mm-hmm. The good guy defeats the bad guy and then all is great until there's another bad guy. And there's this like finality and a very specific timeline. And what you're naming about these processes is that time moves in a very different way when we're really feeling into feelings, harm, healing, and even changing potentially very culturally prescribed and supportive behaviors. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot we have to grieve around that if we're going to engage in these processes. And so what are some of the things you think we kind of need to start unpacking, grieving, and really grappling with if we're interested in moving in this direction?
Oh my God, great question. And let's talk about white supremacy for a moment.
Yes.
As always with me. So white supremacy and white supremacy culture has a couple of tenets. Again, these are not tenets that I made up. You can look up white supremacy culture for more information if you're curious. But some of the tenets that a lot of us were raised either directly in because it's part of our racial legacy, because of our, bloodline, or we were raised in it because we were raised in an environment where white supremacy culture dominated. There's a lot of rules and there's a lot of promises that we were given. Mm-hmm. We were told that maybe if we were good enough, we would be all set in the world, that if we worked hard, we would be provided for, that if we were just, if we just tried our best, if we were good, if we followed the rules, if we didn't deviate from gender, if we were heterosexual, if we were all these particular kinds of things, we would be okay, or we would be safe. And what a lot of people notice as they move through the world and grow up and discover their identities or discover, their lineage or anything like that, is that that's a lie. It's all lies. And it's only a true promise for a very select few. And even for people who do gain a lot of that safety and gain a lot of that capital and gain a lot of that power, there are still harms that come to them because of how white supremacy works. So everyone is impacted negatively by white supremacy, albeit in different ways. And some of the tenets of white supremacy and white supremacy culture are perfectionism, are a sense of urgency, are binary either or thinking, and individualism. And so all of these things give some of us a sense of, oh, this is how the world is. And I can predict it, and there is a right and there is a wrong, and it is very clear, and there's no ambiguity. And, if I just work fast and work hard, it's all going to be okay. And losing that is awful.
Yeah.
And some people were never actually given the chance to even think that they could aspire to it, right? Because very early on, they were disabused of that illusion. But for those of us who may have had it for 2-3 years of our lives, 5, 20, 30, 40 years, some of us are still grappling with it, right? The idea that the world is not what we expected it to be is really, really hard. Yeah. If we wanted the either or, if we wanted the simple answers, basically what I'm saying is we don't have those simple answers and they aren't even real. And having to deal with your world getting deconstructed, it's just, a carpet pulled out from underneath you and you're just stumbling onto the floor, cracking your head. Like that, it is painful. It is awful. It feels like you were lied to your entire life. Like it's not pretty. And if we don't admit that, if we don't admit that there is grief, I'm glad that you brought that word in specifically. If we don't admit that there is grief, the process is going to feel really, really hard and we're not going to be sure why.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people, when they try to engage in accountability or when they try to grapple with causing harm or having been harmed, if they're working under these rules, they're going to have a hard time because the rules were not set up to roll around in the ambiguity. They were set up to hide ambiguity and to pretend that it didn't exist. So we have to grieve the promises of the American dream that a lot of us were given. We have to grieve the alleged certainty that we were promised. We have to grieve the simple world that some of us were told we would have if we were just good enough. And we have to grieve our own sense of self as good people, which I think is one of the harder ones to do there. Most of us don't want to think of ourselves as monsters. Most of us don't want to think of ourselves as people who could grievously hurt others. And to do this work and to do it well, we all have to contend with those parts of us that could and will cause harm. Even if it's not, you know, top level, you know, murder half the world harm, it's still harm and it still matters. And that's really hard to do, to just sit with, there are parts of me that are not nice. There are parts of me that could hurt other people, even unintentionally, but especially intentionally. That's not what a lot of us have been trained to do. And there's not a lot of safe spaces to talk about that. So then we're asking people, you deal with that on your own, right? Do you deal with it in secret? Grapple with the horrors of your soul in secret and don't tell anyone. And that's isolating. And, you know, as maybe a lot of your listeners know, isolation is one of the, you know, the biggest predictors for death, for violence, for, you know, suicidality, for depression, because we are a social species. Humans were meant to be in connection with other people. And if we are divorced from that through choice or circumstance, but especially circumstance, we don't thrive. And we fall apart.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of what makes that particularly challenging is so many of us are getting so many of our social needs. I will use the word met loosely with social media. And I think one of the things we see is that it's rare to find spaces on social media that allow for messiness and uncertainty and not getting things right. And I think that that also contributes to this sense of, I either have to do the thing perfect or I'm not going to do the thing at all. And both of those things contribute to just the ongoing systems of violence that we've already got.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And I mean, a lot of this, I think you mentioned, right, comes back to community. Yeah. And if we think about community accountability, right, one of the questions that I ask in my little intensives on restorative justice or things like that is, who is your community? Like, who would you count as your community or your communities? Are there different definitions that you use for that? Are there the loose definitions that are based on identity? Like, yes, the queer community. But is there a more local geographical definition for you around that? Is there a specific online space that is your community? Who are your people, basically? Mm-hmm. And to have a community accountability, you need a community. Yeah. And you need a sense of community to some extent. And especially for groups that are dispersed across the globe, especially for groups that have tenuous meeting spaces online, you know, due to censorship or due to, you know, poor Wi-Fi infrastructure or natural disasters or things like that, it can be really hard to create a sense of community that would then provide the foundation for the accountability processes to work. And one of the things that I'm exploring a lot, and I don't have, you know, concrete answers for right now, but the thing that I'm exploring right now is how to build sense of community and how to build thus community accountability across a distance and across communities or fields that are not well-defined, right? So how do we build that sense of community and togetherness and care so that then when harm arises, we can actually deal with it as a community? Because community building requires trust. And when you're trying to do community accountability work without trust, it's extremely, extremely difficult. And so you can see that with some of the more sort of public accountability processes in kink, alternative sexuality, and sexual education spaces, because we're trying to work around, you know, we're trying to work around issues that maybe we weren't prepared for. You know, the rise of social media, the rise of technology that allows us to connect over a long distance. You know, we have parts of what it takes to build community, but not everything, and we're still trying to figure it out, I think.
And I think what's so important about what you just said, which reiterates some of your earlier points, is when harm arises. It's not if, mm-hmm. it's when. And I think one of the things that we often find ourselves inside of is not really dealing with how to deal with harm until harm has occurred. And mm-hmm. then we're all hurt, we're all traumatized, we're all up in our feelings, things are confusing, and we don't have the tools because we haven't really felt into when harm arises, and it will, what are some of the things that I want, I need to practice, want to talk to others about practicing. I mean, laying some of that groundwork is so crucial, but because culturally that's not supported, we kind of flail until something happens.
Mm-hmm. I was recently at an advanced circle keeping training with Kay Prentice, who is one of the sort of the big names in circle keeping work. And one of the questions in that training is not a question that I was unfamiliar with. Like, I've thought about it and I've talked about it before, but it hit me in a particularly new way at that training. And it was a question of, what do we look like when we're at our worst? What do we look like when we're at our most triggered? What do we look like when we're at our cruelest or meanest? Most of us don't talk about that with anyone. Yeah. Most of us don't have spaces where we get to show that quote unquote ugliness, or you know, whatever we want to call it. And to me, that is such an important part of these processes, just acknowledging that that's there and also being able to communicate it. Because if we can communicate it in a community, that community can then help us beyond the watch for it. Right. Yeah. And it can also help our community better understand when we are in that space, when we're in that moment. So I'll use myself as an example. When I get like my ugliest version of myself, my meanest version of myself, is I am very cruel and condescending and dismissive and cold. And, you know, I'm just waiting for the other person to lose their damn mind. And I'm just going to look super cool and calm over here. I'm going to be that logical bro who, why are you so freaked out right now? And that is horrible. Like, yeah. I know that about myself. And that is a part of me that I work so hard to understand and to also ward against, because it is a very damaging way of being. And a lot of us are told that harm is when you're violent, harm is when you're loud, harm is when you're big, harm is when you're aggressive. And a lot of people, and I would say especially a lot of white people, don't see and don't understand the harm that silence can bring, the harm that the quiet dismissal can bring. Sometimes that's even worse because it agitates the other person further. And so if I can know that about myself, and if I can tell my community, hey, this is what I look like when I've lost my entire shit, they can be ready for it, and they can pay attention to the signs and be like, hey, it seems like maybe this is happening. What do you need? Or they can know, you know, how to better deal with it, or how to talk to me about it, or, you know, it can spark further conversation. So that's one of the questions that I would encourage all listeners to think about and consider: who in your life could you tell that right now? Who in your life knows that about you already? And do they know because they were told? Do they know because they witnessed and were harmed by you doing that? And if we're able to even just have that as a part of the conversation, it can help us prevent and pre-plan for when those parts want to come out. Because, you know, we're not going to say, well, we're just going to keep that, you know, we're going to keep that monster in the basement. Like, I'll never get that level of angry. I'll never feel badly enough to be that level of angry. Buddy, life takes a lot of turns. Life takes a lot of turns. I'm a trained therapist, educator, you know, fairly level-headed person. And even I, with all my like letters after my name and all my training, sometimes just want to like rip the world in half. Mm-hmm. So of course, people with less resources than I will extremely want to rip the world in half, or will want to eject themselves out of the planet. So let's not pretend that those pieces don't exist, and in fact, try to address them as directly as we can instead.
One of the things that's striking me about that is I'm kind of thinking about like the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about how because of the systems and the cultures we have at play, that there is this sense of entitlement that comes with, especially being like a cis white man, and how to really be able to find, to one, be willing to ask the question, and then to two, genuinely be able to move into that space, there has to be a breaking up with at least a certain level of the entitlement, the like, I deserve these things and it's not my fault if you can't deal with that kind of attitude. Like, I mean, there's a humbling that has to happen as part of this process, because it is acknowledging I can be terrible and I can hurt people, and now let's talk about that.
Well, and honestly, so my main demographic in therapy work is not cis straight white men. Most of the folks that fit those markers come to me for through other avenues, especially couples therapy. But they end up being some of the clients that I'm not gonna say they're my favorites, but they're
can the be rewarding.
Are the most, unexpected based on you know where I've gone with my work. And the ones where I can see sometimes the greatest community impact when they get it. Because, you know, a potentially controversial statement that I've made before is, until men, and especially white cis men, get their shit together, no one is safe in the world. And that doesn't mean that it's, you know, cis white men have to save all of us because, no, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that until they have their shit together, loosely defined, the world will have to be working against the harms that they are perpetuating. And I'm not saying, right, I'm not saying that they are the only ones who perpetuate harm. I literally said that that's not the case 20 times earlier, right? But that because of the way that society has been structured, especially in the US, based on how power especially has been structured, they are the ones that are generally at the sort of at the peak in terms of resources for power, for money, things like that, and are also the ones that are least resourced in a lot of emotional literacy work. And so, you know, if they don't have access to those resources, it's very difficult for them to be able to get that humility and lead that entitlement. They are some of the ones that have to grieve, honestly, the most, because they are the ones that fit the criteria for the promises that I mentioned earlier. They are the ones who were told, you will have the world. And when they do, but they see that they are harming other people that they care about, or when they don't get the world, or when that is challenged, it freaks them out. And a lot of them get angry. And anger is a secondary emotion. Under anger, generally, there's always hurt or sadness or insecurity. And that is a part that not a lot of folks in power positions get to explore or acknowledge that they have within themselves. Like, again, I'll use myself as an example, and I'm not a cis white man, but like, you know, close enough, I guess. I know that if I feel angry, or if I, sorry, if I feel targeted, or if I feel unsafe, or if I feel like I messed up, generally, my immediate reaction would be defensiveness. Generally, my immediate reaction would be anger. I don't want to be wrong. I don't want to be seen as causing harm. Who does, right? And it has taken years of work and, you know, and messing it up to get to a place where that is not my only immediate reaction, right? Like, now that can be one of them, but I also have thankfulness. I also have surprise. I also have apology. There's a lot of other options that I have available to me. And that is what I wish for a lot of folks. Like, I want them to have not just their anger. I want them to be able to feel other things and see, you know, people calling them to account for harm as a gift, as an opportunity for growth, as an opportunity to make the world better through sheer, you know, ripple effect. And I want people to have curiosity. That's one of the biggest, best tools. You know, if you ask me, like, what are the tools you would take to a deserted island where you would have to do this work? Curiosity would be a huge one. That would be the biggest one. Because curiosity can lead to conversation. And honest, you know, curiosity can be an antidote to defensiveness. Because it's not, why would you do that? You know, how dare you do that? You did this wrong. It's, how did this make sense for you? My favorite question is, how did this make sense for that person? because I assume it will, right? We don't do things out of accident. We don't, oops, just, I just did things. There's reasons that we do what we do, whether it's conscious or unconscious. And when we build that question in, how did this make sense for you? It presumes a level of giving a crap about the other person. Like, and if you care about me and if you care about why I did what I did, that, at least for me and for a lot of people I know, makes them inherently and generally less defensive, because I'm not having to fight. I'm giving you my story. That said, for some people, any question will be interpreted as an attack. Like, I have clients where, again, especially in couples therapy, clients where any question that I asked, no matter what tone, no matter what, was seen as an attack on them. And so for those folks, the work that they had to do was start interrogating, why do I interpret every question as an attack? And honestly, what comes through for a lot of those folks is they're afraid of being known. They have never been asked truly and honestly, or they have a history where they were asked and ignored or isolated, and they've built up defenses against that. And if they've, you know, if they've built up these wonderful defenses, anyone seemingly trying to tear them down is going to be seen as a threat. Yeah. And that's why, to me, any kind of mental health education that takes into account things like attachment styles, things like trauma responses, things like, you know, emotional literacy overall are so crucial for this. And just for being people, like relationships. If you're in a relationship with another human, whatever that relationship is, you would be greatly improved in your skill set by knowing things about trauma, by knowing things about, you know, how to identify emotions, and what the arc of a conflict generally looks like. Mm-hmm. Because that's where a lot of us get stuck, and we get, you know, we get wrapped up in, oh, well, I didn't mean it. Or we get wrapped up in, oh, well, they looked at me wrong. Or, oh, but now everyone will know that I was bad. And there are so many tools at our disposal that we just need to disseminate and make more available. That's where I think a lot of the collectivity and sharing comes in. And then that's why I hop on podcasts like this. You know, the more people know, here are some things maybe you should be learning and practicing, the more we will have that muscle, that like collective muscle in action, right? We can't expect ourselves to go from 0 to 60 on anything. So why would we expect that we could fix things or we could do community accountability after never having practiced it? We have to practice it in small bits, and then that will give us the strength to work on it in bigger and higher stakes situations.
That makes me think a lot about Adrienne Marie Brown and emergent strategy, and how like what we do on the micro and our most personal relationships is representative of the macro. Mm-hmm. I think that's so important. Like, if we can start practicing accountability and some of these different ways of being with harm and being able to reveal some of these ugly parts of ourselves and have them held with our closest, it becomes so much more likely that we're going to be able to do that with larger groups and people we don't know as well. And to, because we've practiced and we've developed the skill set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, the question, again, the question is, or one of the questions says, right, is when I'm angry, what do I do about it? When I'm angry, how does my body feel? When I'm angry, who gets to know that about me? When I'm angry and I want something to change, how do I enact that change on the world? Is it through violence? Is it through a request? Is it through bottling it up? Like, those questions, most of us don't give ourselves time to mull over. And again, for listeners, give yourselves like 10 minutes randomly on a weekly basis, or give yourselves half an hour on a weekly basis to mull over some of those kinds of questions, so that you can, A, get to know yourself better, certainly, but B, see how those work, and are they serving you? Are they serving the people around you? Is there anything that you need support around?
Yeah.
Right? And why it's scary to sometimes open up those questions is because it's a Pandora's box. Sometimes you've been suppressing something for so long because you feel like there's nothing else you can do with it. And again, suppression is one of my favorite defense mechanisms, personally and professionally. But it's time limited. We can't put something in the basement of our brains forever and expect it to not grow and fester. We can't put it down there and expect it to just be waiting till we're ready to deal with it for 25 years. Especially because a lot of these things that we repress or suppress end up coming out somatically. They end up coming out through weird, you know, things that our bodies do. And a lot of people don't even realize that they have trauma or that they've had something buried in their brain basement until they're suddenly having, you know, a seizure, or they're having a twitch, or they're having deep, you know, intense stomach pain that has no medical explanation other than it's psychosomatic. And that's where a lot of the psychosomatic stuff comes from. It's from wounds that we are not looking at, and it comes from a lot of suppression.
So one of the other things I'd love to just explore a little bit is, you had mentioned that some of the things that we kind of need to grieve is not wanting to be bad, but also recognizing like it's inevitable that we're going to cause harm. And one of the things that I've noticed in response to some of the kind of a community accountability practices I've seen, like with Eve and Franklin, with Reed, with some other folks, is I see this process starting where a lot of it isn't made public. And then people, specifically in like social media spaces or in blog spaces and community forums, coming in and wanting so many different things from the person that caused harm. And I'm really curious about how we can do better around that, because often the demands that are coming at someone are just unfair, unrealistic, just it's not possible to do all the things that are being asked for, but to then explain that often then escalates kind of what's unfolding in those discussions. And so how do we kind of make space for, if we're engaged in an accountability process, maybe we've done harm and lots of people come at us with lots of demands and requests that just aren't something that we're capable of doing, what do we do?
First step, know that it's going to be messy. Embrace it. Just know my Virgo ass hates it, that it's messy, right? Like there's a part of me that's like, oh, but can it just be orderly and neat and beautiful and fit in my color-coded spreadsheet? Why? And it doesn't work that way. And frankly, that's actually part of what makes it in some ways really beautiful and interesting, is that it can be so chaotic. But a lot of us don't thrive on that kind of energy. And so knowing that from the get-go and seeing, okay, I know it's going to be messy. So how do I support myself through this mess? Who do I have to call on? What do I have to, you know, change in my schedule to deal with the fact that it is de facto going to be messy? So that's step number one. Step number two is getting a sense of who you're counting as community. Ooh. And who are the people that, you know, you are counting as stakeholders in the situation, and to what degree are they stakeholders, right? You know, if you have an issue that's pretty public with Franklin and Eve, for example, and all the other people that have come forward, not just Eve, there's a wide, like, radiating circle. I'm thinking of, like, just, again, a ripple image. There are different stakeholders at play, some that are closer to the issue, some that are further away. And whatever process someone is engaging in, you have to be very realistic about what resources you have and how far, you know, in that ripple you can actually make change. Or if you want to make change across all those expanding ripple sets or rings, know that the resources and that the change will have to be different for each of those.
Yeah.
Right. So the change that processes like, you know, the one with Franklin and even the other survivors are doing, they can't account for everyone's needs. And so they have to be very clear, or I would advocate, you know, that people are very clear about who they are prioritizing, how they are processing, how they are even listening to people, right? So if you have more resources, one of the things that can be really nice is having discussion circles, or having town halls, or having submission forms where everyone who wants to be heard can be heard. Being heard, though, doesn't mean, and now we are going to do everything you say.
Mm-hmm.
And to set yourselves up for success when doing that, it's very important to, from the get-go, lay out sort of what the expectations are and what you can actually offer, right? Because if you tell people, come in, tell me what you feel, you know, blurt all your feelings onto me, most people expect something, even if they're not telling you that they expect something.
Yeah.
And if you don't deliver, then they're going to be upset, and, you know, rightfully so. So if instead of just come, tell me your feelings, you say, hey, come tell us your feelings. Here's what we're going to do with your feelings. Here's what capacity we have. You're letting people be able to better consent to when their story comes out of them. Mm. So if you're saying, okay, this is a listening circle, what we're going to be doing is just opening up a space for people to be heard. We don't plan to incorporate this in XYZ way, but we do plan to incorporate it in XYZ way. That can be really helpful. Because then people know what they're getting into, basically.
Yeah.
The other part of that too, in terms of sort of managing all these mixed expectations, is, again, here's me being a Virgo about it. with a lot of processes that I'm in, we have a designated people or a team of designated people that just write down and grab all the different things people are saying. It's like, get every piece of critique, everything people are asking for, just like, let's compile it on a spreadsheet or in a document or somewhere. And then let's take our values, and then let's, like, the values that we have as a team for accountability. And let's take the restorative or transformative justice questions that we're using as a guide, and use those two things as a filter for the requests. Mm. So for example, what that looks like in practice is, you know, in an accountability process that I was a part of, we had some meetings from the beginning talking about, what are we doing? What are the things that we value, right? Like, doing specific values clarification activities about harm, about teamwork, all of that stuff for the community building of our own team. And picking, are we trying a more restorative approach? Are we trying a more transformative approach? You know, what's our guideline here? And then getting all these questions and seeing, okay, how do they fit with this? So for example, if someone is asking, hey, this person is a teacher and they caused harm of this kind, my request is that they never teach again. That may not be a fair request,
no.
Right? Based on the kinds of questions that I use. But what is the kernel of that? What is that person trying to get at with this request? Maybe what they're worried about is that this person will perpetuate their harmful mentality to other people because they're a teacher. Mm-hmm. So what are the safeguards that we can put in place to address the underlying concern without necessarily, quote unquote, caving to the superficial request,
right?
Maybe someone is asking, oh, this person needs to never come to these events again. Again, probably a question of safety. Maybe they don't want to be triggered when they go to an event. What are other ways that we can actually meet that underlying need rather than, this person is banned forever. Mm-hmm. Maybe what we do is, this person is banned for a year, right? Or maybe this person is banned for 3 years, or maybe they have to come with a buddy to events, or there's a lot of different ways to get needs met. And I think sometimes in these processes, we make our requests from a place of fear or scarcity,
yeah,
or black and white thinking, and we lose our creativity. And when we can actually tap into the creativity for problem solving, that's when a lot of the more sustainable and actually transformative options come forth,
mm-hmm,
because they're not coming from that place of punishment that most of us were indoctrinated into. So a lot of this is doing deep work and deep self-discovery around, what are the tentacles of punitive systems that are in my body and in my thinking that infuse everything I do, and how can I, you know, I'm not going to get rid of them 100%, but how can I, you know, mitigate their effects, right? If I'm angry at someone, do I want them to be, you know, gone forever? Cool. That's probably a more punishment-based strategy. Are there any other options? What am I actually seeking? Is there any other way to get at that?
Mm. So you've already been touching on this a little bit, and I'd love to know if there's anything else that you'd like to expand on, but having been a part of multiple community accountability processes in a variety of roles with different communities and different situations. What are some of the lessons you've really learned over being through multiple of these processes? Things that maybe now you think, oh, wow, if I had known that in the beginning, I would have done things differently.
Yes. don't go public too soon with your process. Which is hard, especially if a lot of the messes and harms were public, right? I think I love the internet. I love technology. I love social media. I love call outs, right? Mm-hmm. And I think call outs are really vital and important, especially when there's a power difference that is being addressed because a call in would not be possible. But that said, doing everything in the public eye, especially at the beginning, gets really messy and it can really be harmful to a process. So I advocate for people to try to do some of that work on the back end first before they're like, here's all that we're doing, you know, blah, please judge us. So that's one of them. Another lesson for me is that you can't skip the community building at all. If you skip it, it's going to come bite you in the butt later. And what I mean by that is not just in the larger sense, but if you have a team, right? If you're trying to build a pod of folks to do a community accountability work, you really need to humanize each other. You need to spend time getting to know who those folks are, especially if you don't know each other very well. You have to, or you should, you know, you don't have to do anything, but here's my suggestion. I would suggest that you get clear on what you as a team value and what you as a team are trying to do, right? What kind of community accountability process are you using? What are the Yali's top five values? Is it transparency? Is it sustainability? Is it urgency and speed? Right? Like, depending on your values, you're going to do things pretty differently. And what happens is that in a lot of these teams, people are coming with different experiences and knowledge bases that are not always compatible 100%. And so then you have the team dynamics of the push-pull. Do you have people's personalities coming into the mix and it getting messy? So if you can try to address that early and try to think through, okay, what are we trying to build here? That can save you a lot of grief. Some of that work can look like values clarification exercises, which can be as simple as here's a list of 200 values, pick the ones that matter to you and let's discuss. It can look like having a communications guide of what are we calling what we're doing? What kind of communications are going to come from the pod versus individuals? How are we differentiating the two? How are we, you know, looking at the urgency of emails? If we have a group email, you know, are we responding to people with 24 hours? Are we responding, you know, over the span of a week? Do we have an autoresponder on the email account? Do we have a website where we're going to put things, you know, and hearing what people feel about it and what they want before you make decisions, again, in that community building stage. Another part of it is these processes will generally take more time than you expect. So some people are like, oh yeah, this is just going to be a couple of months. And then surprise, it's a year and a half later and you're still doing the work. Another lesson is people will drop out. Sometimes because they misinterpreted what the ask was, sometimes because they, you know, had a life circumstance change. For whatever reason, you will have people that leave. And so when doing anything like this, it's really important to make it okay for people to leave. You don't want people in a pod that are hating every second of it. They're not going to be your best support at that time. Yes. And it's not going to be helpful for them. So make it okay to leave. Make it okay to ask for support, right? And think through, okay, what do we as pod members or team members need to be able to do this successfully? What kind of communication do we need with each other? What kind of, you know, support do we need from partners or family members or things like that? And sort of giving that permission for, hey, this is going to change, right? Like, we're not always going to have the same people. That also relates to documentation. So how can you ensure that you have the documents that you need accessible to all the people that need them? Because if someone drops and just literally drops off the face of the earth and they were the ones who had access to all the documentation, you're going to be screwed. Yeah. So another piece here is generally have at least two people leading whatever it is that you're doing. Don't have one person being the lead on anything by themselves. In part, that's because of, you know, what if someone dies? What if someone drops? But also, we all have our own baggage that we're bringing to this. And having another human to bounce ideas off of can be really helpful when we're maybe over, when we are maybe overreacting to something or reacting maybe more from a place of scarcity and things like that. So having multiple people as vectors of information, that's also really helpful if you have any interviews that you're doing or if you're, you know, talking to, you know, someone who caused harm. It might feel like ganging up on if you do it wrong, or if you don't do it with a lot of care, but it can also mean, hey, this is not just going to be a, you know, they said situation. We have a little bit more wiggle room. Those are some of the bigger lessons that I've learned thus far. The other piece here is, you know, about not committing to too many of these at a time. I think a lot of people get excited and they're like, "Ooh, I did one. I want to do more." And then they are up to their eyeballs in work. And it doesn't serve anyone. And the other piece is, a lesson I learned through doing this. I think the more that we do these for quote unquote smaller offenses, the better we're going to be at doing them overall. And so if I had known about this, you know, 20 years ago, and I could tell my 20 years ago self, like, hey, you should maybe start looking into this. You don't think that any of this affects you, but it's going to. And if you start practicing now, you're going to have such a better handle on it. So I would encourage people to, you know, hey, did someone gently piss you off in your household or in your community? Can you try to do like a mini version of this? Start practicing now so that it doesn't catch you by surprise when you have to do it later. Just making this a community norm. Those would be, I think, the top lessons that, you know, have come to me through doing this work for now.
Oh, such a big yes to like all of us just starting this sooner. God, yes. So the last question that I'd love to ask you for this main part of the episode is around the fact that this is a process. Mm-hmm. And I think culturally speaking, and you know, I'm sure a lot of this is deeply informed by white supremacy and capitalism. Mm-hmm. But we tend to want answers, solutions, endpoints. We want to know that if we go through this program, we take this course, we do this process, that at the end we're fixed, we're healed, we're done, we're the expert. And one of the things you mentioned before we hopped on is that going through this process doesn't mean that on the other end, someone is all of a sudden A-okay or knows all the things. It's an ongoing process that's going to have all kinds of things on the other side of it. So what are some of the things you think you either just want to share around that or that you've even had to kind of feel into and grapple with around when we engage in community accountability processes, the end of the process doesn't mean like the end of all the work.
Mm-hmm. And again, that's another piece to grieve, I think, since some of us really like it when things are tied with a neat little bow. For me, a big part of that has been shifting my value system, frankly. I know that in a lot of ways I was raised to value certainty. I was raised to value science and objectivity and values neutrality, which I think is the scam, but okay. And thinking about, you know, all these ways that we were taught maybe to believe, and considering that there are other ways that we can look at the world, considering that there are other options that we can, at whatever age we are, hold on to instead. So for me, embracing a mentality of possibility, embracing a mentality of growth, embracing a mentality of change has been really important. And when we're doing that work of shifting what our values are or shifting what we think the end goal should look like, it's important to know why we're doing that, right? Like, okay, if I'm going to give this thing up that has given me a lot of security, why? Why would I do that? Yeah. And to me, A, it's more realistic. If we want to, you know, be, if we want to look at the work of Adrienne Marie Brown, a lot of what she talks about is that that's how nature works too. Nature has a lot of lessons for us in terms of, you know, structures for community building, structures for not just being individualistic overall and you know, thinking differently. And there's this piece also around, I'm trying to think about how to phrase it. Possibility and growth are more forgiving.
Yeah.
And for me, that's where a lot of this makes sense and why I gravitate toward it. I also don't want to be punished and thrown away, right? And I don't want to be just flat out wrong. And so if I can have a mentality that says, hey, it's okay to be wrong sometimes, and it's okay to change, you always have another chance. Like, that to me is really attractive. The idea of we can grow, we can evolve, we're never done, which means there's always room to fix things. There's always space to be better. We don't have to be stressing out over, did I do it perfectly enough? Did I, you know, do it and am I done? And also that's why it's scary, right? Because if we're never done, it means that we can always mess up. It's like, well, the, you know, double-edged sword here. But everything is a double-edged sword. And yeah. So let's at least pick the cutest sword in the bunch that can give maybe more of us a chance for healing. And you know, this piece around, we were talking about earlier, people having expectations that are calibrated to the criminal legal system. Those don't have a place, frankly, in this kind of work, because with the legal system, generally there is a, well, you did the trial, you did the time, and now you're done. Like, you can't be tried for the same thing twice. I'm also talking on my butt because I'm not a lawyer, but here we are. But there's these expectations, right? There's these expectations that, oh, the trial happened. You can appeal, I guess, but, you know, there's only so much you can do. And that kind of thinking is really limiting. And so that's some of what we have to remove to be able to do this work and show up for it fully. And knowing that if we do this work and if we dedicate ourselves to it in whatever ways we can, what we have on the other end of it is a world that is more resourced, a world that is more nourished, a world that is more liberated. And while that can be terrifying to a lot of people, having that is beautiful. And beyond the fear or beyond the anger or beyond the, oh God, what do I do with such freedom? There's a lot of choice and there's a lot of expansiveness and a lot more opportunity to get our true needs met and not have to settle. And not have to make ourselves small because we only have two options, you know, and this goes also for things like gender. If we only have two options, that makes it simple, which can be nice, but also we lose on such variety. We lose on such depth and creativity that could actually be really amazing. And, you know, I encourage us all to move away from this kind of binary thinking about justice or binary thinking about, you know, love and abundance and gender, because there's so much more available that just a lot of us have not either experienced or allowed ourselves to experience. And so that's what I would invite people to open themselves up to. What are other ways of seeing the world? What have I been told that might not be the only, like, the only way of seeing how I exist in this universe?
Well, we are going to continue the conversation for a few minutes for our Patreon supporters. But before we do that, can you share with people how they can find you online and stay in touch if they want to see all the amazing things that you're up to in the world?
Yes. It is ridiculously easy to find me on the internet if you just have my name. So my website is www.aidamandulely.com. So it's aidamandulely.com. I am on Instagram under that same name. On Twitter, I am Neuron Bomb. I have a newsletter that has not launched yet, but will be launching soon. I'm on social media. That's a great place to kind of stay on top of my going-ons. And I present and work all across the country, though I'm based in Boston. So for clinical work, I'm here. I'm extremely not taking clients right now. I'm up to my eyeballs with requests. But you know, you can always ask and I can always let you know what's up. but the online is probably the best way to find me. That's the place where I am most consistently in existence.
I will have all of those links in the show notes and at sexgetsreal.com for this episode, plus links to the accountability pod around Eve's process, the survivor pod, and the PayPal, so that we can all help financially support the people who are putting their time and energy and labor into doing these processes differently. Thank you so much for being here with us, Ida, and being so generous and sharing your perspective and your experiences.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Yes. To everyone who tuned in, please keep in touch. You can email me at info@sexgetsreal.com or head to sexgetsreal.com to submit a question. You know I love hearing from you. And until next time, I'm Dawn Sarah. Bye.
You used to light up like a spark. Now you're blue, treading water in the dark.
A huge thanks to the vocal Few, the married duo behind the music featured in this week's intro and outro. Find them at vocalfew.com. Head to patreon.com/sexgetsreal to support the show and get awesome weekly bonuses. As you look towards the next week, I wonder, what will you do differently that rewrites an old story, revitalizes a stuck relationship, or helps you to connect more deeply with your pleasure?
So don't be ashamed. Love is-